and philosophical balance, not directly with claims of divinity. So, the emergence of the classical systems not only provide civilizational identities, which they certainly did, they also suggest some movement away from some of the previous cultural staples of the human experience. The classical systems shared a few other points in common, some of which add up to a few additional complexities. They were all surrounded internally by a certain amount of diversity. In India, obviously, during much of the classical period, Hinduism and Buddhism rivaled each other outright. Again, they share a number of assumptions. They're not entirely different, but they certainly had some distinctive emphases, and they certainly had a healthy rivalry during much of this period. Classical China was, as we've seen, marked not by a single basic statement, Confucianism, but by a certain degree of tension between the Confucian interest in political order in this world and the Taoist emphasis on the importance of a more contemplative association with nature. Classical China also saw the emergence of a third cultural strand called legalism that almost directly disputed Confucianism by arguing that human nature is in fact bad, and that the goal of political order, which, broadly speaking, was shared with the Confucianists, could only be achieved by an authoritarian government, by harsh punitive measures that would lead to obedience rather than spontaneous orderliness of the sort the Confucianists hope. Classical India, to go back to that case, was marked not only by two great religions, but by an important interest in science. Classical Mediterranean saw, obviously, a variety of scientific systems, different artistic schools, different emphases. So, while it is valid and important to see the classical period as developing certain kinds of overall signatures that would, as we've argued, among other things, be reflected in art, it's also important to note that these were complicated civilizations with different groups appealing to different specific schools of thought, sometimes even clashing directly. But on the whole, and this is the final point about internal diversity, the classical period was marked by a considerable range of tolerance. Confucianists, for example, could easily tolerate Taoists, sometimes even sharing beliefs in the same person, so long as Taoists did not tamper with their fundamental commitment toward the importance of basic loyalty to the state. When Taoists made this concession, not necessarily urging active political participation, but at least passive loyalty, the two schools of thought could coexist quite easily. Classical Mediterranean rulers turned against a few specific cultural strands, notably Judaism at several points, Christianity at a few points as well, when these strands seemed incompatible with political loyalty. But beyond this, again, there was considerable tolerance for diversity. So, the classical systems were unsurprisingly not simple. These are rich, varied civilizations evolving over a considerable period of time, and they involved perhaps more tolerance than we might expect from civilizations that were still in early phases of development. These systems of thought, these systems of belief, were for the most part also not actively missionary. The one key exception in this period, Buddhism, stands out for its willingness to spread beyond conventional geographic and cultural boundaries in the interests of converting other peoples to religious truth. But with this exception, most of these classical systems worked hard to develop a considerable consensus among elites within the civilization, but they did not have any particular interest in spreading their systems beyond. Again, it was as if the proponents of these systems were aware that what they were doing was providing a cultural definition for a civilization, not a statement for humanity as a whole. This said, the classical systems inevitably had some influence beyond the borders of the major civilizations themselves. Confucianism, for example, would begin to have some impact on Korea and Vietnam, even though these territories were not part of Chinese civilization proper. Hinduism, although not for the most part a missionary religion, fanned out with other aspects of Indian influence, particularly merchant activity, to locate Hindu centers in other parts of Southeast Asia and in present-day Indonesia. Most of these have now disappeared, but there are still a few centers of Hindu religious practice and artistic interest outside of India proper. Classical Mediterranean perhaps had slightly less resonance, among other things because it didn't produce quite such a compelling religious or philosophical system, but there too, peoples on the fringes of the Hellenistic world, on the fringes of the Roman Empire, could at least sense the impact of classical art, if not the richer findings of classical science and philosophy. So these are not missionary packages for the most part, but they do have some influence in creating a cultural borderland around the classical civilizations per se. The most important question to ask about the classical cultural packages is the extent to which they gradually reached out toward ordinary people. I've emphasized that, as in the case of China, the initial cultural emphases focused particularly on helping to shape a common cultural vocabulary, a common set of assumptions for members of the governing elite. And there's no question that this remained the predominant purpose even at the end of the classical period. Equally obviously, for China and the Mediterranean at least, and in a way classical India as well, the clearest beneficiaries of these cultural systems were members of the elite who had time to indulge in some of the richer treasures of artistic achievement, who had time to explore the literature and philosophy that these cultural systems involved, who had the resources, among other things, to educate children in these cultural systems. Ordinary people had a less clear stake. And without any question, in all three of the major classical cases, ordinary people continued to work more traditional cultural veins. Popular religion, for example, in China, would continue to reflect a belief in a multitude of divine spirits, would continue to reflect the need to use symbolism, for example, dragon symbolism, to express different spiritual forces in nature and to help people protect their homes against adverse spiritual forces. Magic, in other words, as well as polytheism, was alive and well in the popular classes in China. The same thing was definitely true in the classical Mediterranean. Ordinary people in the cities, and particularly the countryside, continued to participate in folk religions that were undoubtedly polytheistic, that undoubtedly had a strong magical content. And periodically as well, these people were swept by mystery religions coming from places like Egypt that would provide a greater degree of spiritual passion than the elite culture or even folk religion normally provided. So, there was an ongoing division between the cultural signatures, the elite value systems developed in the classical period, and the belief patterns of ordinary people. But there was also spillover, which is probably an equally important point for the long run. Gradually, if not Confucianism in a full sense, at least certain Confucian values reached well beyond the upper class to help ordinary people understand their relationship with the upper classes, to help ordinary people understand that they could use Confucianism to insist on courteous and sympathetic behavior from the upper classes, to help ordinary people understand that they could use Confucianism to organize their own households. Confucianism, at the end of the classical period, was hardly a mass cultural phenomenon, but it wasn't entirely elitist as well. The penetration of cultural systems in the Mediterranean probably focuses particularly on artistic forms. One of the great claims for classical Athens in the 5th century was the extent to which ordinary people, particularly from the cities, would come to see the great plays, would hear the great musicians, would participate in the public representations of sculpture and architecture. So there was a popular spillover in this case as well, probably much less at the level of philosophy and science, but certainly at the level of exposure to the artistic values that emanated from classical Mediterranean culture. Almost certainly, cultural packages spread farthest in India, probably because they were so integrally wrapped up with a larger religious expression. Ordinary people could see in Hinduism or in Buddhism opportunities for spiritual expression, for hoped-for spiritual advancement in this life or at least the next phases of existence. And while Hinduism had not reached its popular apogee yet at the end of the classical period, India was a case in which value systems initially emphasized by upper-class figures, the priestly castes, etc., value systems could spread quite widely. These cultural systems, in other words, to one degree or another, are important not just because they described identity, not just because they provided some partially new bases for ethical behavior on the part of figures in the elite, but because they could move ordinary people as well, usually in combination with some continued belief in polytheism, in magic, and possibly even in a few cases, the divinity of rulers. We should end by re-emphasizing the balance between diversity and commonality. Diversity, again, is the more obvious point. Once the value systems of Confucianism and other ingredients were developed in China, vis-a-vis those in the Mediterranean, for example, Chinese people could have a very different reaction to basic experiences like anger or old age from their counterparts in the Mediterranean. Chinese emphasis on restraint, for example, would hold anger or revenge activity in much greater disrepute than was true in classical Mediterranean culture. Chinese culture would also hold old age in greater veneration than Mediterranean culture, which placed a greater premium on youthful qualities of youth and vigor. These cultural systems, in other words, are not just abstract. They really describe fundamental reactions to ordinary issues in human behavior. So diversity is a lead theme. And when civilizations began to contact each other, for example, when at the end of the classical period Buddhism began to spread from India to China, the diversity element, even with this contact, required that a considerable revision of the Indian version of Buddhism be undertaken before it could be even remotely palatable to a Chinese audience. Diversity. But commonality as well. Remember, the common elements of these classical systems were an emphasis on cultural values that could be widely shared with in the civilization. The emphasis was on an effort to provide cultural arguments for obedience to the existing social and political order. And as a result of this common aspect of the classical cultural experience, the classical civilizations all, although each in a distinctive way, all generated value systems that would have lasting impact on the regions in which they were created and sometimes well beyond.
Lecture 6, Social Inequalities in Classical Societies.
The focus of our discussion today rests on the social systems of the classical world. I want to make three basic points. First, frankly, fairly easy, each of the classical civilizations, and I'll be focusing on China, India, and the Mediterranean, each of the classical civilizations had a somewhat distinctive social system that marked its particular definition of social inequality. And each of the classical civilizations also had a slightly different version of a patriarchal gender system. And I'll be looking both at class structure and at gender structure in illustrating the social points about these civilizations. So point one, following from what we've been talking about in terms of culture, each of the classical civilizations emerged with a slightly distinctive social signature. Second, again, frankly, pretty easy. The social systems of the classical world in general were fairly different from what we expect today. Much easier acceptance of inequality, much easier acceptance of legal definitions of inequality, much different cultural framework for inequality overall. And again, that goes for the class system and the gender system, both. But third, and here's where I get particularly personally invested, I also want to argue that these social systems made a difference, that it was not just random that classical Mediterranean emphasized slavery, whereas classical India emphasized the caste system. And I make this third point, that these social systems mattered, with two basic justifications in mind. First is very personal. They're both actually a little personal, but first is very personal. I was trained as a social historian, which means that I think the histories of ordinary people are an important aspect of our sense of the past, that ordinary people have a real historical legacy of their own, and they also matter in terms of the stories of the larger societies in which they existed. So as I moved into world history also, I've had an abiding interest in trying to show that social experiences, social structures matter in the framework of world history as a whole. Most world historians would agree, but it's obviously true that world historians have so much to think about, so many different societies, so much need to attend to major ideas, major political institutions, that the social can drop off a bit. The second personal element here is actually even more focused. Several years ago, I was talking to historians at Washington State University about a world history program that they were about to install. They've since installed it, and it's very good. And two older historians in the audience, probably a little critical of world history, challenged me when I was trying to make the case that we need to pay attention to ordinary people. And the argument went as follows. Yeah, in the past, there was a great deal of inequality. So you need to say that the classical period was marked by inequality in which a minority of wealthy, powerful people rode roughshod over a majority of ordinary people. That's true. And men tended to do the same to women. That's true. You don't need to say any more. One paragraph will do it. You don't need to worry about differences among the civilizations. Let's keep this topic short so that we can get back to wars, emperors, and great ideas. This is a really interesting challenge. So what I want to do is lay out the simpler parts of my argument, the different social systems that describe the classical civilizations and the gender systems that matched, and then turn tentatively, because this is not entirely worked out, to why does this matter? Why does this need to be known beyond simply a matter of record? Okay. The first place to start actually touches base directly with the previous lecture. I ended on the statement, each of the cultural systems in the classical world, although each had a variety of purposes in exploring truth, beauty, and spirituality, each of the cultural systems managed to provide explanations for why people should remain in their social place, why social inequality was both necessary and justified. The Greek philosophers, people like Aristotle, argued specifically that slavery was an essential system for the conduct of society because only with slavery could enough production occur to support the upper class with appropriate leisure for contemplation and wise rule. So the argument was you needed a dramatically unequal social hierarchy in order to generate the resources for a minority of people, the aristocrats, and aristoi meant rule of the best, for a minority of people to rule wisely. Confucius wasn't quite so blatant, and he didn't have to justify slavery, which was much less widespread in classical China. But Confucius argued something of the same thing, as we saw last time. Confucius said that a minority of people in the upper classes, the gentlemen, would be wise, would know the appropriate rules of conduct, would be able to govern well. They owed this to the lower classes. There was a reciprocal obligation between upper and lower class, but hierarchy was obviously essential because the lower classes had to do the productive work and, along with deference, supply the needs of the upper classes, and in combination alone would this hierarchy manage to produce a properly organized, orderly society. Buddhism's a little bit more challenging here. Hinduism made the social inequality statement quite directly. Different people are in different social layers. If they do what they're supposed to in their current social layer, they will earn the right, right's probably the wrong word, they will earn the possibility of spiritual advancement so that in the next life, they will either be in a higher social level in this world or will rise to a higher spiritual sphere altogether. Doing what you're supposed to do in a system of social inequality was what you had to perform in order to achieve spiritual advancement. Okay, none of the systems was totally designed just to justify inequality, but they all did so, and this is an important component they have in common, even though their specific methods are very different. So point one, in contrast to the modern world, where our cultural systems are a little bit shakier when it comes to justifying inequality. We certainly have inequality, but we're a little bit less glib and self-satisfied in assuming that it inevitably explains itself. The classical world very clearly said, at least in the mouths of upper-class people, social inequality is essential. We have nothing to apologize for. There's no alternative to it. It's just there. Okay, so the first framework for the social systems of the classical world, the first framework was cultural. A widespread set of assumptions, widespread at least in the upper classes, but potentially spreading below as well, that inequality was just it. There's no reason to worry about it. It just exists. The second feature of the classical social systems needs to be stated very carefully, but it also helps, along with culture, explain why these systems worked. The systems were not absolutely lockstep. India, for example, had a caste system. And on paper, this sounds extremely rigid. A person is born into his or her social station. This social station describes what jobs are appropriate and what jobs need to be done by somebody else. Describes whom you can suitably marry, describes whom you can suitably have social contacts with. It was a network of regulations that really helped describe daily life and obviously social relationships. But although this was on paper the most rigid of the classical social systems, it also was not inflexible in a couple of ways. First of all, wealth levels could vary considerably within a caste. You could be a poor priest, a poor Brahmin, or a wealthy one. And there were subgroups within castes called jati, and one could move among these with much greater ease than one could among castes, where technically it was impossible to rise until a subsequent reincarnation. The classical Mediterranean world was described, among other things, by slavery. And the slave systems in Greece and the Hellenistic world and Rome were really extensive, tending to grow with time, and that's important. On the other hand, classical historians caution us not to think of Mediterranean slavery exactly as we have been taught to think of more modern Atlantic slavery as it developed in the early modern world. Slavery could involve extremely harsh working conditions. Slaves were used in the Athenian silver mines and elsewhere, and often had very short life expectancies as a result. But more slaves were involved in domestic service, tutoring, even running stores and shops, with some real latitude in what they did. They were property. They were owned, no question about that. But it was not a system where you need to think of gangs of laborers working under the lash. That was part of classical slavery, but not, frankly, the whole thing. And as an evidence of this, classical slavery could be seen by ordinary people as an actually desirable state. Many poor people actually tried to become slaves because although you would lose your legal freedom, you might gain in material support, and you wouldn't suffer necessarily very much in work performance. So, caste system, slavery, don't necessarily mean what we think they mean when we look at them through the eyes of subsequent history. The same holds true for the Confucian system, although again we need to be somewhat cautious. Confucianism urged a distinction between gentlemen and ordinary people, but every so often, without any question, an ordinary person could actually rise to the status of gentleman. The system worked like this. A really bright peasant boy, if really bright, and lucky enough to be identified by the local landowner, might be supported into an education that would allow him to achieve a position in the imperial bureaucracy. In other words, none of these systems was as static as they seem on paper. All of them had some loopholes. In the case of Mediterranean slavery, also the loophole of manumission, where owners freed their slaves. This wasn't the normal practice, but it wasn't all that rare, certainly more common than in later Atlantic slavery. So, along with the cultural justification of these systems, come an understanding that the way they operated on paper and the way they operated in fact were not entirely the same thing. Caution, though. Americans, perhaps particularly American college students, think so routinely in terms of social mobility that they're likely to turn this statement about flexibility into an unrealistic assumption that, well, actually mobility was common, mobility was expected. Mobility occurred, flexibility existed, but it was not expected, and you need to weigh the flexibility I've just described against the cultural cement for the insistence on social inequality itself. The third feature of the social inequality of the classical world, and again, it varied a bit depending on whether the system was Mediterranean slavery or Confucian inequality or the Indian caste system, which was particularly distinctive. The third feature is that, with some obvious exceptions, lots of social groups, although technically unequal, didn't have routine daily contact with each other, so that although they could be seen as inferior from a bird's eye view, on a day-to-day basis, they didn't necessarily operate in that framework. Peasants, for example, certainly could be subject to exactions by landlords, and these could become very troubling, but on a day-to-day basis, they weren't bossed around by landlords. The landlords weren't their employer in a modern sense, and they often had a considerable latitude to do their work, to operate their village institutions, to operate their folk cultures without too much interference. Indian historians, some of them, without apologizing for the caste system, which really by modern standards seems pretty bad, Indian historians have argued, I think plausibly, that the caste system itself allowed a certain amount of daylight among groups, because if you followed your caste obligations, if you didn't try to assume inappropriate relationships, you actually on a day-to-day basis might be left with substantial opportunity for your own group culture, your own group contacts, not a lot of routine interference. This also may help explain why social systems that to us look markedly unequal, stark in their inequality, could function and could actually produce a certain amount of flexibility. Turning to gender. The gender systems of the classical civilizations were patriarchal. We've argued earlier that patriarchy was the common gender currency of agricultural societies and certainly of agricultural civilizations, and that is unquestionably true. A dramatic illustration of this gender inequality was the extent to which many classical societies, probably particularly classical China and classical Greece, depended on quite high rates of female infanticide. That is, in order to limit birth rates, individual families, implicitly supported by communities, would kill off, usually by exposing them to the elements, would kill off a certain number of female newborns, up to 20-25% probably in the case of classical Greece, because by doing this, they were obviously first indicating their preference for sons, but second, reducing the potential for subsequent birth rates that could overwhelm family and community resources. Infanticide was not unknown for boys, but it was much less common. Boys were preferred. At the same time, just as with the